Now, what was your question, sir?
My question is, how come a great historian like Charles A. Beer did not even know that Anna Ella Carroll existed as late as the year 19... 19-
and the tour of what's his name, who was warning us that the British were coming?
Washington.
Not Washington. Paul Revere. And we have 96. No. Yeah.
17? Yeah.
No, 1700 about. And it's full of ancient periwig gentlemen. You can see just going around the corner.
In the form of bats and mice.
And squirrels.
And squirrels.
And so we greet you upon this strange day. Tomorrow we're going to record Robin's speech. That she made, that her maiden speech she made at the reception. And it was really a hit. And we recorded a party for Sam Horowitz, and we recorded his mother and his sister from Brooklyn.
And oh, by the way, I don't think Brain knows about the tape recording.
Oh, don't you know about the tape recording, Brain?
No. Let me speak to Bernie.
Yeah.
I don't think he does. We had a great big party, and there was a lot of wonderful people there. And the big narrowed out the tape recorder, which is a Revere, R-E-V-E-R-E.
I thought you said that Bernie was the one who said he should get that tape.
Yeah, he was. But I want you to know that we got I don't know if it has all the speeds on it, but the speed as we're going now, I don't know the socks so Kai. And he stood me up a couple of nights, and I got kind of angry at him, and so I didn't see him again for a long time. And one day I got new. Annie was in New York, so I've been wanting to see Annie. And I asked hey, how about you letting me see Amy? Where is she? Kai said, oh, well, sometime I'll tell you. And then he changes the subject often, so I don't see her. So I see him a couple of times. And so finally I get real mad about the whole thing and say, well, the heck with it. And Mother gives me some kind of strange news one day, all the strange things.
I met him coming out of the office, you know, scooting along, and he wouldn't tell me anything. Finally, some people asked me, what's with him? I mean, what's so secret about everything? And then told me this.
Well, Mother tells me all sorts of kind of weird things. I didn't know what to make of it. And then early one morning, I was in New York, the phone rings, and it saved me. So fine, I said, hi, Amy. I'm meeting me today for lunch. Come down, meet me at work. You know, I'm working in New York now. So she said, fine, I'd love to see you. Well, I was a little bit surprised. I thought maybe, you know, that she was underneath the ground someplace. And then, you know, took her head out until summer. So anyway, I met her for lunch, and she's just fine. She's looking wonderful. And I asked her, well, I'd give her the lowdown. She's married. Who's she married to? Carol Perry. And so, of course, I was a little bit surprised. And not only that, but they have a four-month-old baby. A little boy. What's his name?
Joseph Andre. You can imagine who asked her.
And Amy says it's Joseph Andre. And so I was like, one word. It could take me a long time to figure out what that name is. And she's very, very, very happy about Sadie.
He was born on the day Vyshinsky died.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's why they didn't remind it.
Oh, I didn't even know that. And she's real crazy about him, and I haven't seen him yet, but I'm going to see him next coming weekend. Children, by Milton Berle. Come, little children, walk with me. Take my hands, I will lead you through forest laughing streams. I will find you magic streams, singing to birds on dusty and smooth-worn stones. I will show you where to send Cathay through the fingers of wrinkled trees and where quick rabbits cease to run. High among the branches we will sit in nests until joyous birds come home with sweet chocolates in their shining bills. We will go to the small lake being drowned by small chairs, blown by the wind into a rainbow palace, making the waters what we will, soft pale green or bright yellow, laughing blue or kissing gray. Little boys with broken arms, come. Little girls with twisted bones, come. Sit here on this grass with me while the hot sun spreads a canopy of shadow over our heads and heals us. We will forget forever the fear of immobile stars starting down and the fear of the strange earth leaping up to the frozen heavens. The sour bread which we could not find, we will forget. Chief Mountain. We will weave our names on the waving grass. We will race among rose bowers, and no voice will tell us choose between the red and white of roses, leaning from the leaves, bleeding or pale among the thorns.
This is Deborah's classroom at Princeton.
Swim, swim, swim. What do you think is going to happen?
I'm going to scare you? Yeah.
Do you think Larry will come? Is that it? Do you think he really will?
No, I mean my daddy will come and he will say, well, I'm scared.
Oh, I see. Is anybody else scared at night?
No!
I am!
No!
Who is scared at night? Karen?
I am.
Why do you suppose you're scared at night?
Because I like the sandman to come in.
The sandman? Oh, what will the sandman do?
Put sand in your eyes.
I can hear you. What?
Put sand in your eyes.
Put sand in your eyes?
Oh, I'm going to tell you that's what he does.
Oh.
That's like a sand in your eyes.
Oh.
Yeah, and I want to see sand in your eyes. I can feel sandman come through a keyhole.
He comes through the keyhole? Well, I can't hear you, did you? What'd you say?
The Sandman is really true.
The Sandman is really true. It's just a pretend fairy story, huh? Just for fun?
I can't wait.
Roger?
I think I'm
a little louder, Roger.
I'm scared
of that. Because the hurricane came down into my window, and then the hurricane came down, and I got up and boom.
Oh, Oh.
No, we went back to bed.
Robert?
No, I was scared. What? I have company, and I have a paper skeleton, and I was hanging on my wall. We turned off the light and closed the door, and I was scared.
Are you scared at night?
No.
You're not really scared at night. Why do you say you're not scared at night and some of the other dogs?
Mommy, my dog.
Oh, it's the open door that doesn't make you not scared. Tell me, Julie.
I'm scared because whenever I get scared, I put my covers over my head, and when I get scared, the wind blows my window, because Mommy always opens the window, and I get so cold.
Oh.
You know what? Stop.
They had to take over their program, practically, because they were afraid they were going to lose power completely, which they did. I mean, so that they moved in this way. They never ran a third party ticket. They don't to this day. They vote in the Republican ticket, and this is the way they came into power. I mean, they simply seized they had a program, they had these newspapers, they had tremendous organization. They started out to get $16 a year from these farmers and to organize them into a political organization, which began at the county level, township level, and had great democratic control in the beginning. It later deteriorated and was part of the cause of its downfall, but in the beginning it was truly a grassroots, started from the bottom, and the pool grew from there. One of the most interesting things I think that happened at this time, and one that really frightened everybody, was that they rented the entire Northwestern Hotel in Bismarck, this nonpartisan elite group. And they had a few legislators, and they were going to get the whole vote of the legislature the next election. They rented this hotel, and they had caucuses. And everybody came, and they had a truly democratic discussion of what was the law, what they wanted, and that not only that, but they had been defeated in some of the caucuses under the Republican, in the Republican county, so they studied parliamentary law, you know, so that they could best their opponents. They learned how to talk. He described here this is a description that one of the made later. The new league legislators were good men, but they weren't used to speaking in public, while most of the opposition were able to talk indefinitely. Those fellows didn't feel at home in a legislative chamber, so we took the chairs and tables out of the hotel dining room, put in a few benches, and spread a little straw around. The falling plaster and hanging pieces of wallpaper were familiar, and they'd come down there and sit, and they felt perfectly at ease. They began to talk to each other and to argue, and before we knew it, there we were, over the legislator, out talking the best of them. And this caucus was a real educational thing. There was an old man last summer, and it was up in northern Minnesota, and we had a meeting there in which we counted up that people came for 1,000 miles in an aggregate to attend this meeting. And this fellow was only 90 years old, and he had been the first legislator elected by the Nonpartisan League. And he was a keen fellow. I have to hurry back before he gets away into eternity, because he was just, he kept saying, he only come 2 years ago, I had a real sharp mind. So he kept us jumping until midnight, you know, telling us these stories. But he told how when they started to write the bills, they knew what they wanted. They knew what bills they wanted. They wanted Hale insurance. They wanted state ownership of the mill and control of the weighing and so on. They knew these things that they needed. But they didn't know the legal terminology, you know. So he said, we brought in some lawyers, because, you know, they didn't do us any good, except to put in the terminology. So he sit there night after night, he described, and it was the farmers who knew what they wanted. And they just used the legal technique of the lawyers. This man later was sued, or attacked, I don't know if it was sued, but by the Bar Association, who claimed that he had taken over the legal duties of a lawyer because he had defended people against the seizures of their land for the mortgage. And he was attacked, they took him up before the Supreme Court. And I said, well, weren't you kind of scared? And here he was, no education, a Scandinavian fellow who'd come over to get away from the, you know, what do you call a Scandinavian where you have to give so many days to the landlord, you know.
Tithing.
Something like, yeah, and he hadn't had very much education. I said, weren't you scared of the Supreme Court attacking you? Oh, he says, I felt just as easy as I do sitting right here tonight. He says, I'm not scared of anything, he says, except to lose my freedom. He says, that was the best time we ever had. Says, nobody was scared. He says, we thought we were going to take over the whole United States. Some other people thought so too, before they were through. Well, this is the way that these laws, I can't go into it tonight, but it's a great story. This is the way these laws were made. And I had a letter from Beanie Baldwin a couple of years ago, and he said he was in Washington, and he had been studying the New Deal and the instigation and inauguration of the laws, Social Security, unemployment insurance, and all these things. He said, I was amazed. He said, not one of those laws of what was written by the Nonpartisan League, written by these farmers, these so-called ignorant farmers that they told to go home and slop the pigs. And they did. They wrote them, and they struggled night after night, and they hammered them out, and they went to the legislature and they passed them. There was another thing that the League had, that nobody should seek office. That the League should go to them. There's a story about the young Lynn Frazier who became governor. Then he was plowing his field, and the committee comes out from the Nonpartisan League and wants him to run for governor. And this is the way that they, in the beginning, that they got their candidates. They would not take a candidate who was seeking his own interest. And even this man, Professor Moreland, who is not sympathetic to the democratic idea. I mean, he really believes that Townley organized the Nonpartisan League, was a great character and a great orator. And Townley was nothing. He was just a reed in the wind. He had a certain flair for talking to men, and he was pushed into this through the necessities, needs of the people. But I saw Townley just a few months ago, and he's nothing. He's an idiot. Because the people have withdrawn from him. In fact, he talks only to the dead, which is only the people he has to talk to. But he was thrown up like the Maccabees into leadership, and he felt as when the people withdrew from him, he fell down into oblivion. He was not a leader of that sort. The great thing of the movement, I think, was the fact that they did, for a certain period, their most live period, it really did throw up these men and really, really imbued them with a social passion, and they grew under it. Well, you see that in strikes, you see that in any social crisis. Well, I have to hurry along here. As you may or may not know, the League grew even despite the attack of the war, and in 1918 had begun to move out into other states, into Iowa, Minnesota, Utah, Montana, and begun to have the idea of controlling other states. In Minnesota, which I can talk about a little bit since I was there, they had one of the most tremendous social experiences I ever had was in 1918, when the first convention to organize the Nonpartisan League was held in St. Paul, at the St. Paul Auditorium. And the war was going on. There was a German population in Minnesota, there was a tremendous attack upon the German population. We had there probably the most advanced fascist organization that even yet has ever been in America, the Public Safety Commission, which was a truly fascistic organization with all the state power in its hands to do anything that they wanted as a war major, to crush the labor movement, to crush the Nonpartisan League, to crush the radical movement. Violence had, the people's barns had been painted yellow. They had parades in which the merchants ran out and threw red paint on the cars that went by. Susie Sagerberg, an old farmer laborer who lives in Red Wing, was telling me just the other day, we think we just had a very hard time about how they were going to have Lindbergh speak in Red Wing. And the merchants told him if they even had a house meeting in Red Wing, that they would destroy the house and destroy the... So they landed Lindbergh in a farm field outside of Red Wing. They had a tremendous meeting of about 4,000 people. And then they decided it was such a success that they just couldn't leave Red Wing, to feel that they hadn't had a meeting there. So they all organized their cars and their wagons and whatever they had come in, and they started to parade through Red Wing. And it was a tremendous, the merchants ran out and threw red paint on them. They tried to kidnap Lindbergh, but they had their parade, and they got through the town, and they felt that they had not been defeated. Well, this is the kind of thing that was going on when the, when 7,000 delegates came to St. Paul and had this tremendous meeting. Many speakers spoke there. There were speakers from the East. There was Lafayette and a lot of speaking by all the liberals of that period, and the people were so stirred up, you know, to think of organizing a nonpartisan league there that I saw farmers were weeping. It was one of those tremendous upsurges of feeling and of organization. And so they started a campaign to elect Lindbergh for governor. Well, this campaign was with great violence. Lindbergh several times was almost tarred and feathered. One time he only got out of Mankato, I think it was, because the engineer was a nonpartisan leaguer, and the engineer got him and took him down. Do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I want to add something. When you're talking about Lindbergh, you mean the father of Lindbergh.
Oh, I certainly do. I'm glad you brought that out. I assume that no one thought it was a junior. yes, Lindbergh's father was a very, he opposed the war, as you know, he voted against the war, he and the Follett. And he was a very stern, very, in a way, severe kind of man. But you couldn't buy him. Sometimes you can read his anti-war speeches, which I'm sure probably in the library. And he was incorruptible and a great man, I think. He was not a rabble-rouser, as they say, like Towneley was supposed to be. I mean, Towneley was a... Well, the farmers used to say about Towneley, you know, a full bottle never runs freely. You know, he talked easy and he talked a lot, but it was only because he was half full. I don't think that they were much affected by him, you know, except that he was an organizer and a good organizer. And I don't know how much you... Well, I propose that you read this book, in which you really do get a lot of information of what they actually did. The laws that they put on the book were really fantastic. They were all the laws, as Baldwin says, which the New Deal carried out. But the thing is that this produced, very much like the struggles of the on the docks here in 34, the struggles of the strike, a tremendous upsurge of the culture and the expression of the people. And this, I think, is like to see this man that I'm speaking of. Here he has been all of this time, an unknown man. He's fallen back to be a little farmer, not very successful. He has no sense of defeat, or that they didn't succeed in North Dakota, or that he was part of a lost movement. The proudest man you could ever speak to. And he feels that for a time he was part of a great organization of humanity. And he understands, because of this, everything that happens in China, everything that happens all over the world, this man knows, because he's like a man who felt the tail of an elephant once. You know, and he never, or like a farmer once told me, he says, you know, I've never known fear. He says, since once I was in a blizzard, and I followed the tail of an ox for 20 miles, he says, that was the most hopeful thing I've ever experienced. He says, I know that it can't be destroyed. Well, there's something in this man. I mean, for 20 years he's been, no one, he was delighted when I came to ask him about this thing that had happened. No one has asked him. And yet he's lived, he's taken part in the struggles, he's well caught up on what is happening in the world, because he had this light, this moment. As he himself said, I saw the possibility of the organization of man. This old man in the country said this in the night. Because I saw that this was possible. That here we were ignorant farmers, and we became poets and organizers, and we were great. We were really great for that time. And he had the same feeling that I had. He said, you know, we had some great writers in that time. He said, we had some great poets. He said, you know, and he knew a great many of these poems that I never heard of, written by his friends, and I suspected that some were written by him, but you know, he wouldn't say so. He said that somebody else wrote them. But he had this tremendous feeling that this was a great moment in his life, and it was. But I would like to suggest this in relation to a people's culture and in relation to the discussion that we had about Mother Courage. I was thinking yesterday that I would like so much to take Mother Courage to the Middle West. And I was thinking of a certain of the attitude towards the farmers. I was talking to a farmer in a very, very bad country that has no good land. And the whole feeling that he had of understatement, of satire, it seemed to me so related to Mother Courage and to Brecht's listening to people. Joseph Sterben went up into this North Country. He nearly froze to death. I thought we'd never get him back without amputating a frozen limb or something. But he was very, very excited. He said, you know, I feel that I'm speaking in slogans for these farmers. He said, you know, they don't speak directly. They don't say, this is so. And he says, I found myself saying to them, this is so. And he says, they just looked at me and, well, I said, you know, you can come around, you can get in the barn from the back way too, or something like that. And he says, this is a new thing to me. He says, I don't think we listen to our people. And I think this is very true, that we there's very little in literature of our so-called great writers that reproduces or shows that anybody has been listening to the conversation and the poetry and the things that are said by our people. I just heard a little newsboy at Sausalito the other day make the greatest remark about the newspaper, for example. He had to carry on a holiday, but during working the first day, he had to carry 23 papers, and he only got 40 cents, and it took him 2 hours to go up those hills. And he said, gee, he says, I'm glad a lie doesn't weigh anything. He says, how heavy these papers will be. Well, who can make a better statement about the newspaper than that? So, I mean, I'd like to, in this connection, I'd just like to read a, I've been threatening you with reading this character whom I call the Dakota Blake, altering this course, but now I'm going to do it. Because I don't think that he is an exceptional person. I think that he represents a whole lot of the kind of poetry and thinking that you find amongst people. It may be a kind of an underground speech that farmers have. I mean, farmers have been for a long time oppressed by an invisible power and to which you could not speak directly. You know, I mean, they have a underground speech, you might say. Well, this Dakota Blake that I call, his name, he was a real person, and I'm going to publish a whole book of his writing someday. His name was Bud Reed, and he published many, many pamphlets himself. He published one of the greatest pamphlets on the Homestead Act and what would become of the land. It's really a political document as well as being a poetic document. But as I think I mentioned, this fellow, he says that he wrote a book, his first book was called What I Think After Thinking. Now Gertrude Stein would have some relation to that. He had been a farmer and thinking through lonely nights and days, worrying about the mortgage, he had come to some conclusion. This is quotes from him. There is little difference between a man who can only feed hogs and the hogs he feeds. That man who takes a trip to the moon with a mortgage tied to both legs to pull him back is just as well off as though he spent all his time feeding hogs. So he decided he was going to come into St. Paul and see Mr. Hill, James Jerome Hill, who was then the whale that was swallowing everybody up in that country. And he thought that he should appeal to him because he was a hauler. It might seem ridiculous, this mighty man, a factor in world building and man building, a rich man, and me, a poor man, thinking about him in a certain way. The poor man can think things a rich man cannot. With a poor man, the wind is always blowing both ways. I've always been in debt. I've been searching for life. He has been searching for gold. While you have been searching for passages tunneling under, I was searching for the invisible. He is loaded with the world's goods. I am empty-handed. He has everything to let go. I have let go of everything. So, he goes to see, he parks his mule with a nose in the feed bag. And whom should he see standing across the street but the state chief, the visible James and the invisible Jerome. His name is James Jerome Hill. The rich man came over and entered the cabin of the poor man, and they spoke together, both agreeing on one thing, that the earth was being neglected and ruined. Hill said, the farmers are ignorant. They have eaten the pedigreed hogs from England I gave them. And Bud said, let me try. You can try, Hill said. I'll give you free run of my train for 3 days. This sounds like a legend, but it's really true. So the poor man rode free on the hauler's grain and many trains. He saw many people, dirt farmers, professors, grain merchants, and succeeded in calling an interstate grain growers convention. This was, about 1900. The rich man and the poor man sat in the hall together, planning how to save the land. And the poor man worried about the rich man, the hauler Hill. He thought, thus far he has laid a few rails and built a few lines on the great ball of earth and is carrying around a few people. I don't say he's going to connect future worlds with his railroad, but I do say that through him will be seen the shadow of worlds beyond. There came a time when many attacked Hill, the ruthless James. Bud sat down in St. Paul, worrying and grieving. He sat down in a hotel and began writing a letter to Hill, telling him how he must become Jerome, the hauler, the saint, and not James, the water of stock, the cinchworm, the locust. And when he finished, he rolled it up like a scroll, walked towards the feudal stone house of the hauler in the early morning, and this is right up at the top of St. Paul, and knocked on the rich man's door, saying to himself, if Lazarus sees me now, I wonder if he will say, there goes another fool to the house of Dives. A servant answered the door, and he handed her the scroll and went back to wait word. None came that day, so the next morning he went to Hill's office down by the river and stood around, and if no one spoke or summoned him, he went away. He lived to a great old age, this Bud, writing his books, publishing, and selling them himself. This was done a great deal in the North Country, and he saw the world in man, in labor, and in growth, and he saw the earth glad because of the growth and energy of man. Another of his pamphlets, printed by himself, was called, To Those Who Are Put, To Those Who Will Be Put, and To Those Who Will Stay Put. It was his theory that the best thinkers in the world were workers and farmers because they were put and they had to stay put. Despite bank failure, depression, flood, famine, they couldn't pull up stakes and hightail it to another place. The man on the prairie, for instance, he writes, has to stay put. The wind is howling, it's dangerous, he's lonesome, he can't move, he has to stay. And that's the reason he's the most powerful man in the world. He will begin to think about solving the light and heat question. He will find out that the drawback, shaking his windows and blowing him to kingdom come, can be used in a window. He'll stay and wake up. These are some of his sayings. It's just picked at random. The people have their house in order. It's a suggestion of the natural forces. The climate demands enterprise and will not accept anything else. I have seen a weed shake its head at a loafer. A hog returns the benefits of his peculiarities, ham, bacon, lard, and sour. Humanity is constructed like a barn. Granite foundation, braces, timbers, shingle nails, some hair in the plastering, some paint, ornaments, the useful and the necessary. Man is very large from having grown into great nations and many peoples, multitudes of whom are coming and going in all directions, all supported by the mother, the earth. Man uses time for a glass and space for a book. I am not here to call attention to great libraries and difficult translations, but to that which is constantly before man, to the world as a workshop. Creation is making something. Doing it is why it is called labor. A worker always knows that razors are not made of pewter, nor bear traps of basswood. There must be more work than talking to accomplish anything. It is necessary to do a lot of hard work to connect man with the world and the world with man. Man, the earth, only grows through labor. If God made man without labor, who would care to hug or kiss such images? Even flies could not find pleasure in feeding on him. Getting out of the shell, breathing, and growing is the proposition. People have long faces. This is the 1900s, remember. There was still a world war and a couple of depressions to go through. Things will be destroyed, they say. But when the pine is used up, there's enough clay to build skyscrapers. And when the clay is gone, there's enough sand to build cities that will never, never die. Everything is in man, and the future is in him illimitable. The dark and sightless end of him points down to his mother, the earth. The light and illumined end of him points up to his father, God. And he can read from darkness and build from shadow. Now I maintain that there's a great writer. Unknown. I mean, I think I'm the only person. I try to find his family, and they don't know him either. I think I'm his only biographer, but I tend to be truly his biographer. I think that the writers like Lindsay and Anderson and Masters had a deep root with some of this. And there are other writers who wrote about this period, like Feitema, and very talented writer and a professor at South Dakota University in France. But they ignore this struggle completely. They don't say a word about all this tremendous struggle that I've just hit upon tonight. I mean, I'm just giving you a slight picture of this. They act as if it didn't exist. It has not been a popular subject, perhaps, up until now. I think there's going to be a tremendous interest in it, and should be. But there has hardly been a professional writer. I feel myself that I have not known how or used that material in the way that I should have until now. I'm just beginning to try to do it. I don't know if I can, but. I suppose it's a tremendous thing, like somebody saying you couldn't write about the Rosenberg, but our digestion has to be quicker, I think, so we can plunge into these areas of the struggle of our people and emerge with quicker expression of it. But they express it. That's the point that I would like to get over tonight, which I've tried to get over in all these lectures. That's the power. And the expression is in the people who struggled and did this. And I think that we have to go back and realize this more and see this great stream. It's like a stream flowing under our lives which we do not penetrate and which we do not use. If you look back I just spent 2 days a couple of years ago going through the files of the Appeal to Reason. Such comedy, satire, poetry. I was overcome. I thought, well, the only thing you can do is try to collect this and make it communicable to people. I mean, this is great. This is great material. And here it is buried in these papers. Or Oscar Ammerling's paper. Or The Farmer Laborer and Nonpartisan Newspapers, which I've been speaking. They contain, I think, the core to our future literature. They contain the mind, the material, the richness, the ore, the uranium, or whatever you want to call it, which the creative writer or artist must emerge from. There was a story in the by Dalton Trumbo in Masses in Main Street about his writing a letter for the prisoner in prison. But I don't think this is really the core of the matter either. It isn't. The writer can write a letter for the inarticulate prisoner, but the writer really should arouse in him his own letter, I think. I mean, the poetry was not in John Howard Lawson in prison. The poetry, not entirely, the poetry is in him also. But the poetry was in the bootlegger who couldn't write. And I think that he should have expressed it, and he should have invoked this in him. Written it for him if he couldn't write, but principally to invoke in him the strength and the power of his own love and imagination. Well, I'm not carping at that. He did invoke that in him. He made him feel love for his wife. He made him express tenderness, which he had become, which he didn't know how to express. But you got the feeling that this great writer expressed it for him. I'm against that. I don't believe that's the thing. The thing is that the writer cannot be great unless he attaches himself to the arterial life and blood of the struggle of the people. And I don't think that we have enough writers of people who feel this. There's this specialty thing, this feeling of a specialist. The writers that we've had it in this class, I mean, like saying, well, why doesn't the writer write this, the specialist? Well, why doesn't the worker write this? Let the writer help him with the carpentry of the thing. But we are not going to make a great literature unless we have the combination of this underground strength and the skill and the technique of the writer. And unless we have the writer at the service of this great imagination of our people. And I think that this is something that is going to develop and is developing and will make a tremendous culture. And I'm very happy because I know the richness of that underground stream and the inexhaustible source that it is in the struggle of our people. We'll have a little break and then we'll have that.